And we find ourselves in a very lonely position. There is a great loneliness in leadership. But I repeat, we have to live with ourselves. A man has to live with his conscience. A man has to live up to his inner feelings. And I think just as a nation does. And we must face that situation. And I think that's all I'd like to say about it today. I know of few alternatives with which we can live, other than the alternative, I think, with which we are immediately faced.
Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast. My name is Kurt Frankum, and I have the pleasure of being your host on this Leading LDS Podcast, where we strive to conquer the many daunting tasks that face us as leaders in the LDS Church. And we do this by asking other smart leaders that have figured it out before us. And today is another segment of the How I Lead segment on Leading LDS Podcast, where we interview such leaders that have had experience and probably more experience than they give themselves credit for. And today we have Blake Dalton on the phone with us. How are you, Blake?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I appreciate you spending some time with me and seeing what we can learn from each other. Hopefully more from you than me.
Yeah, I'm excited. This will be fun.
Good. Now, maybe give us, where are you from, where you currently live and so forth?
Right now, actually I'm from West Valley City, Utah. That's where I live, born and raised, and I've been married for going on 15 years, and we have 5 children.
Oh, cool. And I'm happy that you are from West Valley, because I'm from West Valley too, and here we are, two West Valleyans. Yep. Just chatting, and we can probably both say we're not in a gang, even though most people think everybody from West Valley is in a gang, right?
Yeah, it's not near as bad as people think. It's a great place. I love living here. It's a great place.
Yeah, I was born and raised there too. Great place to live. Sure, there's bad areas, but there's a lot of good areas as well. So it's a fun place to grow up. And what do you do for work?
I have been a teacher for the last 4 years.
Oh, great. And any prior career before that?
I've had a couple jobs. I worked as when I first got home from my mission, I worked for a furniture company here called RC Willie, and worked there for a few years. And then I was an oxygen delivery man, where I delivered oxygen to people with respiratory problems and stuff like that. And that was a lot of fun, and a lot of interesting things happen. And after that, I worked for, a company that inspects pipelines for like oil companies and stuff. And I worked in their data analysis department. So kind of a wide range of things that don't go together very well, but a lot of great experiences. It's been a lot of good life experiences, I think.
Well, I bet, none of that is, a match for teaching.
No,
that's a very beneficial role that you play in your life.
Yeah, what I found through that time was that I really wanted to be a teacher, you know, as I went through all those things. And it was a pay cut to teach, but for some of those jobs, but it's definitely a lot more rewarding. So,
And where did you serve your mission?
I served in the Oregon Eugene mission, and I think it's been split a couple times since I left, but. We serve mostly over by the coast to the mountains, so the real green and moist part of Oregon.
Wow. Okay, cool. Now, you have had various leadership callings and in the church. You said you've been an elders' quorum president for about 6 years on the High Council and in various presidencies, auxiliary presidencies. And now you're currently serving as the executive secretary to your bishop.
Correct. Yeah.
And how long ago were you the elders' quorum president?
Well, I served I served about, it's probably going on about 8 years ago as Elders Quorum President, but I was in the High Council for, a little over 6 years after that. And it's been a little while, but while I was in the Elders Quorum, or in the High Council, I was assigned a ward most of that time, and I was working a lot with Elders Quorum presidencies and high priest group leaders and stuff like that, and training and working with them.
Cool. Now, I have not served on a high council. My brother has, and he sort of tells me he went from serving in a bishopric to a high council, and he says it's the most lonely calling in the church because there's really no, like when you're in a bishopric or an Elders Quorum presidency or, you know, various other callings where there's this camaraderie with others and you feel like you're a team and you have presidency meetings. Mm-hmm. And on the high council, you're sort of just sent out there to figure it out yourself. Did you feel that?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting calling, and I think your brother probably hit it right on the head. I think it depends obviously on the stake and the stake president and stuff, but you never go to your ward. You're always the visitor in another ward, and there gets to be a time where you don't know anybody in your ward and you know everybody in another ward, and then they change you and you go to another ward, and you're just kind of, because you don't really have keys and you don't have any specific responsibility because you represent the stake president, and he says, you know, go and do this, make sure this is happening, so you're doing what he's asked you to do, but you're not in charge of anything other than what you're asked to follow through on. And so you're right. It is kind of a calling where you try to find your niche and try to do the best you can. And, it is, it's not very defined or definite. Like if you're an Elders Quorum president, you know, okay, these are my people I'm working with. This is who I am, you know, taking care of, and this is what I do. And you're kind of just that consultant, an advisor that comes in and, into the ward, and people ask your opinion, but you know, you're always the guy who's just visiting. And so it does kind of feel a little lonely sometimes, I think.
Yeah, wow. So now I know just from, you know, the handbook, the rough responsibilities of a high councilman, but during that time as you serving on the high council, were you generally an advisor to a ward all that time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a bunch of different opportunities you can have. But yeah, generally I was in charge of the sports for a little bit. I was in charge of, so like the stake sports and organizing that, and the like assigning speakers, all those people who love when high counselors come and speak to your ward. I was in charge of assigning those speakers, but mostly I was in charge of a ward, or would go and visit with wards or training different various callings and stuff like that. So
Now one of the roles as you are an advisor to a ward is you're supposed to sort of be a mentor to the Elders Quorum president, high priest group leader, or kind of a go-between between the ward and the stake. How, maybe describe what are those roles? How does that work?
Well, it can be as busy or as non-involved as you want, as you make it. And I guess that's goes for any calling, but, one thing that I would really like to do is, especially with new Elders Quorum presidents, you know, try to help them, give them direction. Most Elders Quorum presidents that are called in or that were called that I dealt with were younger men who just newly married, and we're going to school or we're working, they're having their first child. And this calling was the largest calling they'd ever had. And so I tried to help them not feel overwhelmed. And in fact, that was an effort of our stake president, was to make sure that, how do we help Elders Quorum presidents not feel overwhelmed? And so we would try to point out, okay, let's minimalize what it is you have to be in charge of, because it can, you know, when you get that calling and you don't know what you're doing, and everybody's calling you and saying, hey, you're the Elders Quorum president, help me move, help me do all these things. And if you could put it in a manageable instead of eating a whole elephant, just eat it bit by bit, you know, and put it in manageable terms and try to focus on how to minimize the concern and the worry of being overwhelmed. And I always felt like if we could make a list and you could see it and look at what it is that was required or needed by an Elders Quorum president, then it would relieve some stress. And that way they could see where they could open up and do more, see more, you know, try to serve a little bit better and more effectively as they, you know, just kind of, okay, this is the stuff that I have to do. And it's not so overwhelming or like a big enigma that they're not sure what they're supposed to do. They just know they're in charge of everything, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that describes, that word overwhelm describes perfectly when I was called as an Elders Quorum president. It was really my first, as you mentioned with others, my first leadership calling, you know, even on my mission. I was a district leader for some time, but really this was my first like introduction to here's the group you're presiding over. Good luck. And I was doing everything wrong. And I sensed that, of, man, there's so much to do. I've got to do it all. And I had no clue how to delegate. My counselors sort of just twiddled their thumbs and waited for me to do everything. And that was my fault. So I would imagine with these, as a high council rep, there's a lot of educating the new president as far as this is how you manage time. This is, and I like how you minimalize everything. That's a great tip.
Well, you know, most, and I'm not sure, other stakes are different, but in our stake and in our wards, you know, we are few and we're working really hard to get everybody going. Often, and I don't want to offend anybody by saying this, but often there was a lot of really good go-getters who are in other callings. And sometimes the bishop would call a really good man to be in the Elders Quorum presidency and then take all the really good people who are willing to do stuff and put them in other callings throughout the ward or the stake chasm. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes the Elders Quorum president is left with a handful of inactive people or less active people to use as counselors. And so that would add to the stress. They'd say, okay, my counselors aren't helping. I don't know what to do. And, you know, and it can be a stressful situation because everybody who wants to really help and serve tend to have other callings sometimes, you know, in smaller wards. And that's not saying that everyone in Elders Quorum, if you don't have a calling, you're a lazy person or something like that. I'm just saying that, you know, we were small and often our Elders Quorum had five people that would attend Elders Quorum. And sometimes those were people you were trying to reactivate or you were doing missionary work with. And so it was hard to, often these guys, you know, it was really hard for them to have the whole burden of being an Elders Quorum president because their counselors were new in the church trying to figure things out. And, you know, and so that can be stressful.
Yeah, it really comes down to the level of experience that's left in the quorum to choose from. And, you know, you get some counselors by your side that seem like good men, and it's not that they're lazy, like you said. It's just that, you know, you ask them to do something. They've never done that before, and let alone you've never done something like that as a new leader. And so you kind of just shrug your shoulders and say, ah, this isn't really working. So I bet that high council role is pivotal in those moments when you just think, you know, nothing's getting done. I don't know why. I asked him to do this, but he didn't do it. And I don't know, like, what to do from here. You
know? We even had a couple situations where the high counselor would be set apart as a counselor to an Elders Quorum president because of, you know, the lack of priesthood leadership or experience in an Elders Quorum, just so that they would feel like they had somebody who could help them, kind of thing. And so that didn't happen a lot, but we had a couple times where that did happen, and that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I've never seen that. That's a good idea. Interesting. So with your, let's go back a little bit to your time as Elders Quorum president. How did that come to be? Tell us the story about when you were called.
When I was called, you know, you get the call to go to the stake president's office and you're not sure what for, and you never think it's for anything like that, especially being young. I was called into, and the funny thing was, is this stake president was at one time my bishop as a kid, because I grew up in this area. And it was really interesting because I knew his family grew up with his kids and he was my bishop. And so it was kind of a candid conversation. And then he asked me to be the Elders Quorum president. And I instantly felt completely overwhelmed. You know, as we talked about before, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to handle it. But, you know, he said that he received revelation. They prayed about it and the bishop had recommended me, and they knew that this was the call that the Lord wanted here in that ward, as you know, as any calling comes. But yeah, I was just overwhelmed. I'd served in the Elders Quorum president for a couple years before, and that Elders Quorum president had served for 8 years. And Wow. Yeah, he'd been there for a long time and done such a good job. And I was worried, you know, similar to like when you're on your mission and you go into an area where there's been a really popular missionary companionship and everybody loved those missionaries and you're supposed to take over, you know, and everybody has that. You called to be a Relief Society president after someone who just did a wonderful job. And this guy had been in there for 8 years, great man, wonderful person. And I looked up to him a lot. He asked me to be his secretary when I first got home off my mission. And just a great man. And so I was just overwhelmed. Can I live up to expectations? Could I handle that? And so, yeah, that's kind of when I got called, that's kind of how I felt. I was just, you know, I prayed harder than I ever prayed before and probably since because yeah. Just the concern.
Yeah. And now, and we'll talk a little bit more about your time as Elders Quorum president, but did you go to the High Council from being Elders Quorum president?
No. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I'm backwards. Okay. Yeah, after I was released and was released for a handful of months, we reorganized our stake, reorganized some boundaries to redistribute membership, and I was released at that time when our ward, I was Elders Quorum president for a couple months in the new ward boundaries, and then was released and called to the High Council a couple months after that.
Wow. So the Elders Quorum president before you was in for 8 years, and you're in for 6 years. That is,
yeah,
that's great. I'm such in a transient area. I don't have. If I get an Elders Quorum president in for a year, I'm like, oh, wow.
Yeah,
he's a veteran here, so that's cool.
Yeah,
that's cool. Yeah. You got to serve so long. So, thinking on your time as Elders Quorum president, and what were the takeaways, the leadership principles? You know, the takeaways that you had in your time there as you sat down with on the High Council with new Elders Quorum presidents, or if you could go back in time and talk with President Dalton day one as Elders Quorum president, what are some of the key leadership principles that you were able to learn and develop during your time in service?
One of the reasons I love your podcast is learning some of those and learning from other people, because I felt like I've never felt like I was doing a good job as a leader. I'm always trying to figure out, okay, what do I have to do to be a good leader? And as a young kid, and we had a lot of guys that were a lot older than me who were in the Elders Quorum, and just trying to, number one, I think trying to get people to know that I cared and that I wasn't just saying things to say them, or trying to go through the motions to be what I was hoping I could be. And I felt like if I could help people understand that I actually cared, that I did care genuinely about them, that helped me, or helped them see that I was being genuine and they could trust me. Yeah. And if I could do that with, Because you know, you feel intimidated by people who are older than you, and just generically, at least I did. And yeah. I worried that, okay, how is this younger person going to tell this older person how to home teach, you know, or you're doing it incorrectly. And, you know, and that was a hard thing. And so just trying to help people understand that I actually did care, and that... Go ahead.
Any examples that come to mind, like or things that you would do to make that happen? Because I know this is a tough part of leadership, is we've all had leaders that come to us and they're extremely superficial, and it the sincerity just doesn't come through. Usually it's in a workplace where somebody has a bonus on the line and they really need you to perform, you know. But any examples come to mind as far as how you really showed people you cared?
Well, it's kind of a slippery slope, but with, you know, if you go to business, and we've all have those guys who, like you said, they, I always call it greasy. Like if somebody's just like, they're giving you all the canned answers or canned statements that they've read out of some book, some leadership book. And it just sounds kind of slimy or greasy to you. You're just like, oh brother, you know? So I try to remember what it was like to have a leader come to me and ask me something and how I felt when they felt, when they, I felt like they were being genuine. And so most of these people, you know, I knew, and I had grown up and known them. There's a lot of newer people that had moved in. And so I just tried to get to know people. There's one case in particular where we had a family move in, and, you know, the husband was in the elders quorum, and somebody had offended them in the ward, which happens a lot, and they had decided they weren't coming back. And I didn't know what to do, because any attempt you make to go over there and say, hey, what are we doing? Those families know you're a project. You know, they know that they've been talked about in ward council. They know you're coming after them. They know all the tactics, kind of like on Singles Ward, if you've ever seen that show where the guy says, I knew all their tactics. I knew what they were doing. I knew they'd bring me food. I knew they'd invite me to stuff. And so you have to break down that barrier and realize that just being a friend and not expecting anything other than just being a friend. And so I would try to find opportunities to genuinely be a friend to that person and not go over and say, hi, this is me. I'm the president and this is my counselor. And randomly, we just stopped by, but actually we planned on it, you know. And so if we could go in, if I could see him outside and pull up and say, hey, how do you get that to work in your lawn? You know, because I've got it, you know, just not trying to seem like you are being a calling. You know, if you are working on yourself being a calling, and it shows, people know when you don't care. They know when they're a project. And so that was my biggest thing, is to seem genuine. And in order to do that, I had to be genuine. You can't fake being genuine, you know. So I had to figure out how to be genuine to people. You know, if I'm going to ask a gentleman who isn't home teaching, he knows he's not home teaching, and I have a stewardship interview with him, and say, you know, and come down on him or talk to him, and talk to him like it's a calling and I'm your supervisor at work, it rarely goes well. If you're talking about numbers, you talk about things, but if you can talk to people as people and see them for who they are and understand that maybe they're intimidated by things or something, and just you have to work at being genuine, I think, especially when you're being asked to do things that seem like business. But, you know, and so I guess, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of what I've done.
No, that's perfect. I like that. At the end of the day, you just got to be real with people, right? And I find myself sometimes knocking on a door and saying, you know, hey, yeah, I'm the local bishop. Like, just kind of like call it out, you know?
Yeah.
Point at the elephant in the room and say, you know, obviously it's sort of my role to come over here and beg you to come back to church. You know, that, you know, and that gets, lightens the mood, breaks the ice. They sort of laugh. And then I just say, you know what? Whether you come to church or not, it's okay if I just be your friend for a minute. Mm-hmm. Like, really, I'm there right there with you. I don't like going to church either, but if I don't go, that a lot of problems happen. You know, that usually gets them to laugh or whatever. But which I really do enjoy going to church. But but just striving to be real and being like, I don't know what I'm doing as a leader, but hey, let's be friends, huh?
Yeah.
Tell me about how you keep your lawn so green, right?
Yeah.
So that's cool. Anything else is during your time? Obviously, 6 years, a long time as Elders Quorum president. Not that we need a, you know, we could probably spend hours on everything you learned during that time, but any other solid principles that come to the surface as you think about that time?
One thing another thing that I thought was pertinent and always tends to come up, and I'm not sure if there's a generic reason it comes up, but, well, number one, home teaching is obviously one of the biggest struggles and worries in all wards. And you could tell by the talks by the brethren and priesthood and stuff like that, that home teaching is a big issue. And so trying to figure out how to do that better. But the comment I always got was, or not always, but often got when people weren't doing home teaching, is they would say, you know, I'm not a numbers person. I don't like talking about numbers. And why do we always talk about statistics, or why do we always talk about numbers as home teaching? And I think that's an attitude for some reason that carries over from missionary work, when people are like, okay, you've got to have this many people in your teaching pool, this many people in the progression pool that they're progressing in different aspects of the discussions and stuff, and this many people. If you do that, then you'll have this many baptisms. And it was always hard to figure out how to get people to understand that numbers represent people, you know? And so I guess it goes back to that being genuine, but, you know, constantly in talking about numbers, I would try to help those numbers be people. And so instead of saying, look, we missed 45 people this month, I would say, you know what, Sister Jensen really missed that visit. Or we've got a couple widows who have lost their husbands, obviously, and we need to, it's almost Christmas. Do you think we could get over and see them? You know, so try to, instead of talking about the numbers, which I've never understood why it offends certain people, because the numbers represent people. And so if we would talk about numbers instead of talking about stats and stuff, we'd talk about the people to bring that to the forefront. Because I found that ultimately, at the end of the day, most things would probably run themselves. If the Elders Quorum President doesn't show up, most things will probably get taken care of. But the reporting and dealing with home teaching is probably one of the most important things that the Elders Quorum President, you know, focuses on.
Yeah, and so you mentioned kind of your approach of humanizing the problem, mm-hmm. or the program, I should say. And any other approaches you had to home teaching that you found worked that maybe you didn't expect to work, or other presidents haven't considered?
Yeah, you know, the gentleman who was my high council representative was an Elders Quorum president as well, and very, very, very inspirational to help me with certain things. And as far as it is, I guess you could call it a tactic or a practice, he would say one of our biggest problems is leaving everything to the end of the month. We always do that. You know, we have all the jokes, all the statements on why home teachers wait till the end of the month, but whatever it is, it's true. So he would try to, his number one thing, and this is what he counseled me to do. He told me to, if the leadership doesn't take it seriously, then the rest of the men won't. And so he would try, like on the third Sunday of each month, cut the lesson a little bit short, and the elders who were there would break off with the presidency. And we just sit down and talk about how home teaching was going, kind of an informal group stewardship meeting. You know, so like if, you know, you separate your districts into whatever counselor is over which district, and they just grab those guys and say, hey, have you seen this sister? You know, we just talk about it briefly. And then by the 25th of the month, we would call all of the elders for the home teaching numbers. You know, we'd call and say, hey, I'm just calling to see if you got your home teaching done. And instead of waiting to the end of the month, make it more a little earlier, so that when we say, oh, shoot, I forgot, you still have a week. And so, you know, that's a way, and it really, when I would do that consistently, you saw that people understood, okay, they're going to ask me about this. I think we're told not to govern by guilt. And so we shouldn't, you know, in the church, we shouldn't do that. We shouldn't say, okay, here's the weekly guilt session. But if they know they're going to be held accountable, or at least have to answer, then it gives that a little more motivation to that desire. Now, you know, those are very business-like terms. And after we've talked about being genuine and stuff, it sounds like that's really, you know, dogmatic and stuff. Sure. So, but if we're, if you, and that's why I say, when you sit down and you talk and say, hey, we've got some widows that haven't been seen, or do you know if this, you know, the Smiths, whoever, are struggling with anything? I know they've, I know the bishop mentioned they've needed some welfare help. Is there any way you could figure out what's going on, or see if there's anything we can do, help them get a better job, stuff like that, you know, so that we go to them with issues, so that they come back to us and say, because people care about people. And if they go and say, yeah, sister so-and-so cried, talk to me about this, all of a sudden that number turns into, hey, we just helped somebody get some food on their table because you fulfilled your calling. And I don't think any, you know, the statement, Elder, well, President Packer, he says, the study of doctrines of the gospel will improve behavior quicker than the study of behavior will improve behavior, right? Mm-hmm. If we could get and help, and I don't know how, but the more people understand the doctrine of home teaching, the reason behind home teaching, then I really believe that behavior will change. When we look at why home teaching isn't taking place, we redistrict everything, or we assign new companionships, and then we still have the same problem, you know. And so trying to model the real reason why we home teach, model it as a caring, as what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to watch over the members of the church. We're supposed to help them and be with them and help strengthen them and in teaching them. And I don't know how you do that without talking and telling the people what to do, because that usually goes in one ear and out the other, you know. Oh, here's another lesson about home teaching.
Right.
But if you can get them to do, you know, and maybe you say, look, can I go with you and then model some of those ideas of home teaching, or, but just try to turn it into a caring aspect rather than this is your weekly assignment and I'll check up with you, you know, every month or whatever about your numbers, if we can turn it to people. And so we try to hold people accountable, talk to them, and have stewardship interviews, because that's, you know, those are really important to get into the mind of the elders who are home teaching and see if this companionship's working, and try to help them understand who they're seeing, to turn it to a real person activity instead of just one more thing they're supposed to do.
Perfect. And the last point you made there is perfect. It reminded me of a quote by Elder Bednar, actually, in his book, Increase in Learning. He says, "Men in the church who do not perform their priesthood duty as home teachers are not lazy. They simply have not understood the relevant doctrine and principles. Such men undoubtedly have been both taught and told. They may know that a home teacher is to watch over, be with, and strengthen, but they have not learned that they do not understand, and they are not diligent," as the word intelligence is used in the scriptures. Or they're not intelligent, as the word intelligent is used in the scriptures. So, perfect. It's, you know, the best thing a leader can do when they're faced with a daunting home teaching task is to step back and say, what doctrines can I teach that will inevitably change their heart to a heart of service? So, perfect.
Yeah.
Well, let's shift gears a little bit to your time, your current calling as executive secretary. What's that experience been like?
It's been good. Like I said, you know, I was in the High Council for a bunch of years prior to that, and I lost contact with nearly every member of my ward. I didn't know anything that was going on, and then I became executive secretary, and I got thrust into knowing a bunch of stuff about, you know, a lot of people that I didn't even know, and had to reacquaint myself with the ward. But it's been good to see how our bishop works and some of the inner workings that he does to to help sustain the ward, and how much he loves the members of the ward, and how hard he works, you know, to help members of the ward. I set up appointments and get a lot of calls from a lot of people. And what primarily I've noticed is that I get to know a lot of people who don't come to the ward regularly, for whatever reason that is. You know, a lot of the people who are asking for welfare help or who are struggling with certain things and need to see the bishop because of certain issues. A lot of the people that I talk to mostly are people who are struggling with inactivity. And I found that kind of interesting, which I didn't think would be the case.
That's interesting. They're generally not the person on the front row smiling at the beginning of church that are needing that help. So now what's a typical week or typical Monday through Sunday? What does the meeting schedule look like?
Well, we have our meetings before church on Sunday, and we have our ward council that we work on, and I take notes, and the bishop makes assignments there, and I try to, he has me follow up on the assignments that he's made to the ward members and make sure that people follow up on those things. And then the real big days for me is the bishop meets 2 days a week. He meets on Tuesday nights and then Sunday. And so Monday night, family night, is when I usually get most of my calls to meet with the bishop, and because everybody is realizing, oh yeah, it's tomorrow and I forgot, you know. So Mondays I get a lot of calls prior to the evening, and so when I get off work, I follow up on all those calls, do a lot of the scheduling, and we have a set of service missionaries, inner city missionaries that come to our ward that help with some of the welfare issues, and so I schedule appointments for them and for the bishop, and so I do those. And then, you know, Sunday is kind of the same thing. Saturday night and Friday night, I get a bunch of calls to see if they can come in and meet. We work together as a bishopric to, you know, just the general stuff, figuring out callings and figuring out where we can do the most help for individuals in the ward.
Perfect. And let's see, where was I? Going back to just speaking more generally about your experience as a leader, what has impacted you the most and made you a better disciple of Jesus Christ during that time?
I think seeing people who, how would I say it? As you look across, if you sat up on the stand, and as a member of the High Council, I was to sit up on the stand, and when I'd first go in and I'd look across the ward and I look at all these people that I didn't know, knew nobody, and we as people tend to place people in situations. We tell ourselves a story and we look at them and we say, that person's got it all together. That person struggles, that person, I don't want to talk to that person. You know, we look at all these people, and as when I first go in, but then when you get deeper into their lives and people come to you with issues or problems, or you start talking to them, some of those people who seem like they have it all together, or I've heard it referred to in our ward, you've never had problems, you know, you don't know what I'm talking about because you've never had problems. Well, we don't know that. We don't know that just because that person dresses nice and it seems like the husband and wife are holding hands and the kids are great and they're perfect because they sit on whatever row and they never make a sound, does not mean there's still issues at school, still issues at home. The job is stressful. Perhaps the job's not paying enough and there's stress in that life, or their marriage is on the rocks, or those kinds of things. And so I guess the many different callings that I've had, my first judgment of somebody is often wrong. And so I've learned, and I'm still trying so hard with this, and even with my job as a teacher, looking at somebody and judging them right away, good or bad, is often a mistake because we don't know what they're going through. And so I try not to, or I'm seeking to do what the Savior does, is instead of treating people how I would want, the statement is, treat others how you would want them to treat you. And I think that's a really good statement, but you have to understand that if I went up and talked to somebody, I'd want to talk about sports. That's usually not what they want to talk about. And so I try to look at people and try to help them know that I want to learn about them and learn who they are and treat them as they would want me to treat them. You know, if, and learn more about them, learn who they are, and really look at people as people and not as situations. That person doesn't have a job, they're a horrible person. You know, if you think that, then you really lose what that person is really trying to figure out in life. And so I just think that one of the things that I've learned the most is often I'm surprised how awesome some people are, and how when I think people are wouldn't be struggling, they actually are going through a lot of struggles.
This concludes the interview with Blake Dalton. Sure appreciate him giving some time and sharing great principles of leadership. The best way for you to help the cause of leading LDS is to spread the message. Share this episode or go to Leading LDS, find one of your favorite posts or episodes or articles, and share it with your bishop or an elders quorum president or a relief society president. That way, we can continue to generate further thought from others about how to be the best leader. Until next time, be a leader, not a calling.